She spoke before a room of scholars in Bridgetown. Her hands shook with passion, but her words met polite nods. She was a leader in the community, a woman with insight born of hard work, yet often drowned in academic jargon and headlines about foreign experts. Why did her ideas, rooted in lived experience, fall silent at the center of the conversation? From the pulsing rhythms of Kingston's grassroots theater to the dusty archives where women's colonial-era writings collect cobwebs, many questions swirl around Caribbean women's voices. They fought colonial neglect, gendered silence, and internal hierarchies shaped by colorism and class. But when their voices rise, who truly listens? This isn't just a question about heritage. It's a question about every discussion where Caribbean women stood ready to speak and were met with silence. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Echoes in the Plantation House. The Historical Silencing of Caribbean Women. The silence didn't begin in modern times. It began centuries ago, in the heat-choked cane fields and cool, high-ceiling plantation homes where Caribbean women, enslaved and free, black and brown, spoke only when spoken to. Their stories were passed down in hushed tones, over open fires, and through lullabies. But in the ledgers of the British Empire, they were recorded as nothing more than laborers, concubines, or nuisances. Their inner worlds, political ideas, and resistance strategies were ignored, not just by the men in power, but by the systems that cataloged colonial life. Even today, we inherit this legacy. Take Mary Prince, for example. Her 1831 autobiography, The History of Mary Prince, a West Indian Slave, is one of the first published accounts of a Black woman's life in the Caribbean. It offered brutal detail and profound clarity. And yet, while British abolitionists praised the book, her voice was filtered through white editors. Her words were recorded, but not entirely her own. Most Caribbean history books highlight slave rebellions, sugar trade economics, and male revolutionaries, Toussaint Louverture, Paul Bogle, Marcassie, in ways that are digestible to outsiders, to be palatable, to make the culture sound interesting, but not too complex, safe, but not too raw. This burden of representation is not the same as being heard. It's a performance, and it comes at a cost. Home is complicated. Diasporic. Women often describe a gnawing ache, the feeling of being caught between worlds. When they return to the Caribbean for Christmas or Carnival, they're viewed as outsiders. Their accents have shifted. Their clothes feel too foreign. Their ideas too bold. But in the West, they're still treated as immigrants. This in-betweenness makes their voices harder to place. They speak from the margins of two homes, never quite belonging to either. And yet, this is also where some of the most powerful narratives are born. Digital diaspora, a new stage. The internet is reshaping this landscape. Diasporic Caribbean women are building platforms that don't require permission. Podcasts, YouTube series, blogs, and Instagram reels are becoming modern griot spaces. Tea with Queen and Jay, a podcast hosted by Black women in New York, regularly centers Caribbean feminist thought. Poets like Safia El Hilo and Shivani Ramlo Chan use Instagram to reclaim Caribbean spiritual and sexual identity. Activists like Leah Gordon and Nayla Kaleda May create online archives that elevate Caribbean feminist history. These platforms bypass traditional gatekeepers, but they also expose creators to global scrutiny, harassment, and theft. Their ideas are often co-opted without credit. Their labor remains unpaid. Their rage is commodified, but their pain is not protected. Still, many persist, because silence is no longer an option. Voices that cross oceans. What does it mean to be a Caribbean woman speaking in the diaspora? It means telling a story that doesn't fit neat categories. It means being fluent in multiple languages, literal and emotional. It means translating home for people who've never been there and refusing to water it down. It means carving out a voice that travels farther than the boat you came on. And that voice, it's growing louder every day. Chapter 5. Not All Voices Are Equal. Colorism, Class, and the Hierarchies of Being Heard. A woman stands up in a community meeting in Port of Spain. Her words are sharp, her concerns valid, but she speaks with a heavy Creole accent, her skin the shade of deep molasses, her clothes simple. The crowd shifts uncomfortably. She's thanked but brushed aside. Moments later, another woman stands, lighter skinned, foreign educated, speaking polished English. She makes the same point. This time, everyone applauds. This is the quiet violence of voice politics in the Caribbean. Because even within our own communities, where colonial masters have long gone, we are still shaped by their hierarchies. And Caribbean women are not equally heard. The colonial echo. The legacy of colonization didn't just steal land and labor. It taught us to rank ourselves. Light skin, fine features, and British accents were once the markers of status under colonial rule. And those values didn't vanish with independence. They embedded themselves in our churches, schools, media, and minds. In today's Caribbean, lighter-skinned women with European features are more likely to be seen as intelligent, professional, or trustworthy. Darker-skinned women, especially those from rural or impoverished backgrounds, are often seen as loud, uneducated, or aggressive, no matter their message. This isn't just about skin. It's about who we believe is worth listening to. The politics of English language remains one of the strongest dividers. In the boardroom, it's the Queen's English. In Parliament, debates are polished, rehearsed, and restrained. But outside, in the market stalls, on minibus radios, in backyard cookouts, people speak freely, raw, real, Caribbean. Women who speak in dialect or patois are often seen as less serious. Their voices are laughed at, dismissed, or subtitled for clarity. Meanwhile, women who adopt Western speech patterns may be praised for their eloquence, but also accused of being bougie, inauthentic, or not really Caribbean. This trap is especially painful for working-class women. Their voices carry the experience of poverty, labor, and endurance, but are often seen as noise, not narrative. Class, the invisible gatekeeper. Across Jamaica, Barbados, and Guyana, class is rarely discussed openly, but it governs everything. A woman from a good family can speak about gender violence and be called brave. A woman from a poor village doing the same may be dismissed as angry or unstable. Even in feminist spaces, upper-class women often lead the conversation, while working-class women are asked to share their trauma, but not shape the strategy. In some cases, women are expected to perform their pain, sharing personal stories for academic research or NGO grants, while those collecting the data build careers off their backs. This is not empowerment. It's exploitation dressed as inclusion. Colorism in culture. Look at Caribbean media, TV hosts, beauty queens, influencers. How many are dark-skinned? How many wear natural hair? How many speak like the average woman from the countryside? Not many. Our cultural institutions still favor a specific type of Caribbean woman. Fair skin, slim, cosmopolitan. She is the face of progress. But behind her, countless other women grind in silence. Teachers, nurses, domestic workers, vendors, whose stories rarely get airtime unless they are victims. Even when dark-skinned women succeed, they are often expected to be twice as talented, twice as humble, and never too loud. Internalized silencing. The most painful part? Many Caribbean women have learned to silence themselves, taught from childhood to fix your hair, speak properly, don't be too loud. They grow up believing that being heard means being less themselves, that their natural voice isn't enough. This conditioning shows up everywhere, from job interviews to relationships. Women shrink their ideas. They soften their tone. They translate their thoughts to make them more acceptable. But in doing so, they also disappear, breaking the mirror. Still, there is resistance. Activists like Kara Springer in Trinidad use art to center Blackness in spaces that erase it. Writers like Akila Jardine and Carolyn Cooper challenge linguistic snobbery in Caribbean academia. Social media creators in Haiti and St. Lucia are reclaiming patois, proudly displaying kinked hair, dark skin, and raw stories. They are not waiting for permission. They are speaking in the language of their grandmothers, and they're building new audiences who don't need subtitles. Solidarity across shades. If Caribbean feminism is to be honest, it must confront these hierarchies. It must ask, who is leading? Who is listening? Who is benefiting from
being heard? True solidarity means stepping back when needed. It means passing the mic without framing yourself as the savior. It means realizing that power doesn't always sound like what we were taught in school. Sometimes it sounds like a market woman shouting across the street, or a domestic worker telling her truth, or a teenage girl defending her right to speak in the skin she's in. Chapter 6, The Classroom Cage, How Caribbean Schools, Shape and Silence. Women's voices, the bell rings. Uniforms are straightened. Mouths go quiet. In classrooms across the Caribbean, from Antigua to Aruba, generations of young women are taught to speak, but only within lines drawn decades ago. Education is supposed to be a path to liberation, but for many Caribbean girls, it becomes the first place where their voices are reshaped, subdued, or shut down. From what is taught to how it's taught, Caribbean education systems are wired to reward obedience and punish disruption. And for young girls, especially those from working class or rural backgrounds, the message is clear. Speak softly, follow rules, don't talk back. Because in this system, speaking out is not encouraged, it's corrected. The Colonial Blueprint. The modern Caribbean school system is built on a foundation laid by British colonial rule. Discipline, uniformity, recitation over conversation, respect for authority. These were the values instilled in the earliest mission schools and public institutions. And though the empires are gone, their influence remains. Girls are taught to sit still, memorize, and defer to authority. Questions are allowed, but only the right ones. Creative thinking is often dismissed as daydreaming. Assertiveness is labeled rudeness. An emotional expression? That's called being too much. It's not just about what girls are learning. It's about what they're being untrained to do, to question, to challenge, to own their voice. Curriculum of exclusion. Open a Caribbean history textbook, and you'll read about the Haitian Revolution, the sugar trade, the rise of independence, but how many pages are devoted to the women who helped shape these events? Rarely do students read about women like Anacaona, the Taino Queen, or Marie Sainte-de-Bazile, who buried the dismembered body of Haiti's Jean-Jacques Dessalines with defiant grace. Instead, the curriculum centers male heroes, male thinkers, male politicians. This exclusion doesn't just erase history. It shapes how girls see themselves. If all the leaders they study are men and all the women are wives, nurses, or victims, what message does that send? That leadership is not for them. That history isn't theirs to write. Language policing. Caribbean girls grow up fluent in two worlds. At home, they speak patois, Creole, or a local dialect rich in color and rhythm. In school, they are told this language is broken. Marks are deducted for using slang. Teachers encourage proper English, reinforcing the belief that their natural voice is unworthy. This is not education, it's erasure. Girls quickly learn to code switch, to sound educated in the classroom and real with their peers. But over time, many forget which voice belongs to them. They stop speaking up entirely, unsure if they're saying it right. Punishment over possibility. In many Caribbean classrooms, discipline is still king. Corporal punishment, public shaming, and strict obedience are widely practiced. For girls, this often translates into a culture of silence. A girl who reports harassment might be told to keep quiet for her reputation. A student who challenges a teacher risks being labeled disrespectful. A teenager who writes poetry about abuse is sent to the guidance counselor, not the stage. Discipline may create order, but it also breeds fear, and fear is the fastest way to silence a generation. Girls who speak up. Despite the barriers, some girls still push back. They start school newspapers, organize student protests, use social media to document injustice. They form poetry clubs in lunchrooms and speak Creole on debate stages, daring others to question their brilliance. In recent years, young women across the region have been leading movements, demanding climate justice, gender equality, and educational reform. In Barbados, teen girls marched against sexual harassment in schools. In Jamaica, students protested the banning of natural hair. In Trinidad, girls spoke out about being denied opportunities based on where they lived or how they looked. They are not silent. They are shouting into the wind, hoping the system is ready to listen. The teachers who change everything. In every island, there are teachers who defy the norm. The English teacher who lets girls write poems in patois. The history teacher who centers Nanny of the Maroons and Claudia Jones. The principal who protects a pregnant student instead of expelling her. These educators understand that the classroom can be a place of liberation, that listening is as powerful as lecturing, that a girl who finds her voice in school might never lose it again, but they are swimming against a strong tide. Rewriting the rules. To truly center Caribbean women's voices, we must start in the classroom. Revise curricula to include women's history and literature. Train teachers to value dialect, creativity, and cultural knowledge. Create safe spaces for students to explore taboo topics without fear of punishment. Empower girls not just to pass exams, but to tell their truths. Because the classroom doesn't just shape workers, it shapes citizens, it shapes storytellers, it shapes future leaders who will one day decide whose voices matter. Chapter 7, When Silence Breaks. Imagining a future where Caribbean women are heard. Picture it. A courtroom in Georgetown where a young woman testifies without fear of being blamed. A radio show in Kingston hosted by a market vendor who discusses policy with the same fire she uses to sell yams. A parliament in Castries where grandmothers debate legislation in patois and are not only understood, but applauded. Now imagine that this isn't a fantasy. It's the future we must build. Because when Caribbean women are truly heard, not just allowed to speak, but listened to, everything shifts. Not just conversations, not just representation, but systems, power, possibility, the cost of silence. For centuries, silencing Caribbean women has come at a price. It cost communities their healers, thinkers, and peacemakers. It cost governments the wisdom of those who organize from the ground up. It cost generations the right to see themselves in the stories that shaped them. It allowed abuse to fester, injustice to repeat, and truth to remain hidden in plain sight. The myth that silence is neutral has been shattered. We now know silence protects the powerful, it punishes the vulnerable, and it poisons the future. But what happens when that silence is broken? Voices that built the region, Caribbean, Women have never been voiceless. They were the ones who smuggled rice seeds and braids during the Middle Passage, who led rebellions disguised as dance rituals, who kept oral history alive during slavery, who nursed independence leaders, who built economies through informal labor, who raised generations on their backs. They wrote poems that were never published, gave speeches at wakes and weddings that shifted minds, sang freedom into lullabies. Their voices were never absent. They were always present, just not recognized. Now, their recognition is overdue. Amplifying, not appropriating. As their voices rise again, it's crucial we don't replace one form of silencing with another. Caribbean women don't need to be spoken for. They need space to speak for themselves. That means funding women-led media, research, and artistic work. Hiring and promoting women in leadership roles across politics, culture, and education. Shifting who controls publishing houses, record labels, and media platforms. Building archives, libraries, and digital spaces where women's knowledge is preserved and accessed without filter. But perhaps more than anything, it means changing how we listen. Not just hearing words, but honoring them, acting on them, building with them. The girls watching now. In rural Dominica, a teenage girl writes her first blog post in Creole. In Nassau, a student union elects its first all-female executive board. In Port of Spain, a 9-year-old girl watches a lawyer on television who looks like her, sounds like her, and says what she always wanted to say. This is how change begins, quietly, one voice at a time, but when those voices echo, they become a chorus, a movement, a reckoning. And the girls watching, they're not just witnesses, they're next, healing generational silence. For many Caribbean women, breaking silence is not just political, it's deeply personal. It means saying no in a family that punishes defiance. It means naming abuse in a culture that teaches shame. It means confronting the pain their mothers swallowed and their grandmothers never named. It's not easy. But in speaking, they heal not just themselves, but everyone who came before. Their voices become bridges between past trauma and future transformation. Because healing doesn't come through erasure, it comes through expression. What a future sounds like. Imagine a Caribbean where every girl learns her history and sees herself in it. Patois is spoken in Parliament. Teachers quote Edwidge Danticat as often as Shakespeare. Newsrooms interview elders as knowledge keepers, not novelties. Sexual violence survivors are believed without having to bleed. That Caribbean is not a dream, it's a demand. And it starts with voices, rising, raw, unfiltered, and unafraid. This isn't the end. This is a beginning, because once you've heard Caribbean women's voices, you can't unhear them. And once they know they can speak freely, truthfully, boldly, they never go back. The silence is over. Now, it's time to listen. Garvey. But where are the voices of the women who fought beside them? Sheltered fugitives, taught secret literacy classes, or ran healing spaces rooted in African traditions? Often, they are footnotes. Sometimes, not even that. The gendered archive academic archives are not neutral. They reflect the values of the people who built them. In colonial times, this meant that female-led resistance movements, especially by Afro-Caribbean or Indo-Caribbean women, were dismissed as emotional, informal, or gossip. And yet these same women were the lifeblood of community knowledge. Women like Nanny of the Maroons, Jamaica's only national heroine, had their achievements mythologized, but not deeply studied. Oral histories about her military tactics and spiritual power survive through song and storytelling. Still, for decades, Western historians questioned their authenticity, while male warriors were analyzed in depth. The problem isn't just that these voices were silenced, it's that we've accepted a historical record that acts as if they were never there. From colonies to classrooms. The colonial education system created a hierarchy of language that still echoes today. English was the standard of intelligence. Patois, Creole, and Bhojpuri, the languages Caribbean women used in homes, markets, and storytelling, were labeled broken or bad. This linguistic bias helped shape perceptions of who was worthy of being heard. Even in Caribbean schools, history was taught from books written in London. Female students were taught to be proper, modest, and quiet. Speak when spoken to. Don't be too loud. The socialization was deep. Women learned that to be taken seriously, they had to abandon their grandmother's voice and speak in the queen's tongue. But even when they did, the silence continued. The price of speaking out. Speaking truth as a Caribbean woman often comes with consequences. Social backlash, religious condemnation, family rejection, professional sabotage. For example, in the mid-20th century, Trinidadian activist Claudia Jones, who coined the phrase triple oppression to describe the compounding impact of race, gender, and class on Black women, was deported from the U.S. and marginalized even in the British communist circle she later joined. Jones was brilliant, but male activists took center stage. Her writings on Caribbean women and reproductive justice were decades ahead of their time. Yet her name rarely surfaces outside of feminist or Marxist theory circles. Even in her adopted home of Britain, her grave lay unvisited for years. Despite being next to Karl Marx, her story is not rare. It's the rule. Silence as survival. In post-colonial Caribbean societies, silence isn't just imposed, it's sometimes strategic. Women learned to move quietly through patriarchal systems, to survive domestic violence without police protection, to rise in male-dominated politics without being labeled aggressive, to share stories through calypso lyrics or doubles entendre in carnival costumes rather than through direct confrontation. Silence, then, became a form of cultural resistance, a way to exist without provoking the full force of state or social punishment. But that survival strategy has a cost. Over time, it trains generations to mute themselves. And in doing so, society forgets to ask, what do Caribbean women know that we've never bothered to hear? The inheritance of quiet. Today's generation of Caribbean women carries both the pain of silence and the power of legacy. Many are now reclaiming the narratives that were stolen, distorted, or ignored. From Jamaican dub poets like Stacyan Chin to Grenadian writers like Merle Collins, from Barbadian gender scholars to Haitian Vodou priestesses, these women are speaking again, not for the first time, but this time without apology. The real question now isn't, why aren't they speaking? It's, why do we still ignore them when they do? And the answers lie in centuries of cultural dismissal, systemic erasure, and fear of what truth might sound like when told in a woman's voice. Chapter 2. The Gatekeepers of the Microphone. Caribbean Women in Modern Media and Publishing. In today's digital age, it's easy to assume that everyone has a platform. We scroll past TikToks from small islands, listen to podcasts made in home studios, and hear Caribbean voices in global music festivals. But beneath the surface, the system remains largely unchanged. The voices that get funded, promoted, and legitimized are still filtered through invisible gatekeepers. And for Caribbean women, especially those whose identities intersect across race, class, and queerness, that gate is often locked tight. The sound of censorship. A young Barbadian writer pitches a memoir about surviving gender-based violence, but an editor in New York says, it's too niche. Try making it more universal. A Trinidadian filmmaker wants to document the lives of market women in Port of Spain, but funders prefer a carnival-themed travel dock. A Haitian poet speaks in Creole about climate justice, but her translator adjusts the tone to make it sound more academic. This is how it happens. Not through outright bans, but through subtle reshaping. Women's stories are accepted, but only when they conform to market expectations, reinforce exotic stereotypes, or sanitize the pain. That's not freedom of expression. That's curated silence. Who controls the mic? Let's look at the numbers. Across the Caribbean, media houses are still overwhelmingly run by men. Radio stations, television boards, and major publishing houses are often led by people who have internalized decades of patriarchal and colonial values. This affects who gets interviewed, who gets published, and whose voice is given space during major events like elections, natural disasters, or cultural festivals. Even women who work in these spaces feel the pressure. They are expected to smile, avoid controversial topics, and never criticize the culture too harshly. If they do, they risk being labeled ungrateful, bitter, or too emotional. Meanwhile, male counterparts are applauded for being bold or provocative. The problem with representation. Representation is often used as a solution. Look, media outlets say, we've included a woman. But representation without authentic voice is not justice. It's optics. Many Caribbean women in the spotlight find themselves coached, edited, or told to tone it down. This is especially true when they speak on taboo issues, sexual abuse, mental health, LGBTQ plus rights, or political corruption. These topics challenge the norms, and when voiced by women, they are doubly dangerous. Take the case of journalist Diana McCauley in Jamaica, who spent decades advocating for environmental justice. While respected, she faced constant pushback, especially when her work linked environmental degradation to government.
Negligence or corporate greed. Male voices in the same field often received more airtime and less criticism. And this pattern repeats across all forms of media, from newspapers in St. Lucia to film festivals in Martinique. Digital spaces, a double-edged sword. Social media has given many Caribbean women a platform they were once denied. Writers like Safia Sinclair, who use Instagram to share poetry, activists like Tamika Gill, who mobilize online for gender justice in Guyana, and young TikTok creators in Dominica, who highlight rural life with pride, all are reshaping the soundscape. But online platforms bring new dangers. Caribbean women who speak out on social media often face intense trolling. Fatphobia, misogyny, colorism, and xenophobia merge in digital attacks that aim to shame, silence, and erase. Some women retreat. Others grow bolder. But the emotional toll is real and often invisible. Language as a weapon. Language continues to be a battleground. Women who speak in Creole, Patois, or local dialects are still considered less educated by many institutions. Their brilliance is often ignored unless translated into proper English. This erasure of voice is a quiet violence. It suggests that only certain ways of speaking are valid, that only certain cadences deserve the microphone. Yet these dialects carry the heartbeat of the Caribbean. They are how women pray, protest, flirt, resist, and remember. Stripping them from public discourse is not just linguistic bias, it's cultural theft. The ones who broke through. Still, some Caribbean women have managed to amplify their voices globally, on their own terms. Edwidge Danticat, the Haitian-American novelist, refused to downplay the trauma of migration and political violence. Stacyan Chin, the Jamaican poet and activist, blends queerness, feminism, and Caribbean defiance in every performance. Ayana Gillian Lloyd, the Trinidadian writer, uses Gothic themes to reclaim ancestral grief and womanhood in the Caribbean. They are not exceptions. They are examples of what happens when a voice is heard without compromise. Changing the channel. The future depends on shifting power. not just giving Caribbean women a platform, but letting them build the platform, run the station, fund the art, own the studio. It
means more Caribbean women in decision-making roles, more funding for women-led projects, more mentorships that go beyond token inclusion. It also means we, the audience, must ask, whose voices are we listening to, and whose are we ignoring? Because silence is not just about what's said, it's about what's allowed to be heard. Chapter 3, Where Silence Holds Power. Oral Traditions, Spirituality, and Women's Knowledge. In the Caribbean, not all voices were meant for broadcast. Some were meant to be whispered between generations, wrapped in rhythm and story, guarded like sacred flame. These were the voices that never made it to the printed page or primetime news, but they held the wisdom of healing, resistance, and survival. When public space shut women out, private space became their power base. Grandmother's tongue. It starts in the kitchen. A girl watches her grandmother crush bush leaves in a mortar, the pestle pounding with ancient precision. As the scent of lemongrass fills the air, the old woman tells a story, not just for entertainment, but to teach. About betrayal, about resilience, about the spirit world. No notes are taken, no voice recorder clicks. But the girl remembers every word. Across the Caribbean, oral tradition has long been the vessel for women's voices. Storytelling wasn't just play, it was preservation. Myths, proverbs, songs, and fables carry truths that formal history ignored. And often, women were the ones who told them. They were griots, guides, and guardians of cultural knowledge. Spirit talkers and silent healers. In communities where access to doctors, therapists, and state protection was limited, especially for women, spiritual leaders filled the gap. Midwives, Obia women, herbalists, and priestesses weren't simply healers. They were counselors, defenders, and keepers of justice. Their knowledge was passed through initiation, not institutions. In places like Haiti, Mambo priestesses served as both spiritual authorities and community matriarchs. In Jamaica, women skilled in bush medicine or Obeya lived on the margins of legality but at the heart of trust. In Suriname, Winti practices link spirit work to daily survival, and often, the women leading these traditions were feared by colonial authorities for that very reason. They didn't speak for applause. They spoke for transformation, and that made them dangerous. The hidden transcript sociologists use a term, hidden transcript, to describe how oppressed people express resistance in private spaces. Caribbean women mastered this. They created alternate worlds in their kitchens, bedrooms, and village gatherings where truth could be spoken freely, even if only among themselves. A whispered prayer against abuse, a coded joke about corrupt politicians, a lullaby that warned girls to protect themselves. These were more than cultural quirks. They were lifelines. Women learned to use gesture, intonation, and repetition to communicate powerfully without ever needing a microphone. Their voices weren't loud, but they were never weak. Carnival, a stage for the silenced. Once a year, the streets themselves became a platform. Carnival, particularly in places like Trinidad, St. Vincent, and Dominica, allowed women to take up space, physically, vocally, symbolically. Through costume, song, and performance, they claimed the right to be seen and heard on their own terms. But carnival wasn't just celebration. It was subversion. Masqueraders used satire to challenge authority. Female performers in calypso and soca blurred the lines between sensuality and political resistance. For 1 week, rules bent. And for many women, it was the only time their voices weren't judged. They were celebrated. Even now, this remains one of the few cultural arenas where Caribbean women can move from background to spotlight without apology. the language of the body. In cultures where speech was controlled, the body spoke instead. From the sway of the hips in dance to the deliberate stillness during confrontation, Caribbean women learned to use posture, gaze, and touch as part of their communicative power. Mothers taught daughters how to read a room, how to signal warning with a look, how to express grief through motion, how to command respect without saying a word. This is not silence. It's another language entirely, one that rarely makes headlines, but shapes entire lives. When elders speak, listen twice. In the hills of St. Lucia, a 93-year-old woman still gathers herbs by moonlight. She speaks in Creole, softly. A younger woman kneels nearby, notebook in hand, recording not just
the names of plants, but the pauses between sentences. Because in those pauses live generations of history. This is how wisdom survives, not through headlines, but through hands. And it reminds us that the question isn't whether Caribbean women are speaking. It's whether we have the ears and humility to listen. Crisis and continuity. As modernization spreads across the region, many of these oral and spiritual traditions are fading. Younger generations are leaving villages, abandoning dialects, and swapping ancestral knowledge for digital convenience, but some are also reclaiming it. Movements in Barbados, Belize, and Guyana are teaching young girls their native tongues. Women's collectives are digitizing old folktales and documenting oral history from community elders. Even within diasporas, new voices are emerging that blend modern feminism with ancestral reverence. It's not just preservation, it's resurrection. Chapter 4, Diaspora, Disconnections. Caribbean, Women's Voices Abroad. She landed at JFK with two suitcases and a promise. This is where your voice will finally matter. Like many Caribbean women before her, she stepped into the cold air of a new world believing that freedom, economic, academic, and personal, was just a city block away. But what she found instead was a new kind of silence, a polite, subtle muting that looked like opportunity, but often felt like exile. In London, Toronto, New York, and Miami, the diaspora glitters with possibility. But for many Caribbean women, migration brings a harsh reality. Being heard in a foreign land often requires leaving parts of themselves behind. The myth of the voice abroad. There's a long-held belief in the Caribbean that once you make it out, you can finally speak freely. The diaspora is seen as the place where racism is less overt, education more accessible, and voices more powerful. But that freedom comes with caveats. Caribbean accents are often mocked or misunderstood in the workplace. Cultural references fall flat in academic spaces. Diasporic women are regularly forced to code switch, to speak in ways that are legible to white, Western audiences. And even when they master the language of their new world, they find that the old world has stopped listening. "You sound foreign now," their cousins say on WhatsApp. "You think you better than us." They are too Caribbean to be accepted as Western, too Western to be accepted as Caribbean. The migration. Mute button. Caribbean women in the diaspora often occupy an awkward space between visibility and erasure. Take the case of Claudia Jones, again, Trinidad-born, Harlem-raised, deported to the UK. She founded the West Indian Gazette and helped start the Notting Hill Carnival. She shaped Black British politics, yet her story is still missing from most school curriculums. Or consider Jane Binta Breeze, the Jamaican dub poet who brought Caribbean oral tradition to global stages. Her performances were powerful, but often misunderstood in literary circles that preferred page poetry to performance art. She gave voice to mental illness and womanhood in ways few dared, but even at her peak, she was rarely spotlighted alongside male Caribbean writers. The reality is this: migration can amplify your voice,
but it also asks you to negotiate who gets to hear it and who decides its worth. In the classroom, in the margins. In elite universities, Caribbean women's scholarship is often reduced to regional interest. A Trinidadian feminist who studies colonial trauma might be invited to speak, but only during Black History Month. A Haitian anthropologist might publish a groundbreaking study, only to have her citations buried under Western theorists. This academic silencing is subtle but systemic. Even within Caribbean studies departments, male scholars often dominate discourse, while female professors report being interrupted, challenged more harshly, or excluded from a key panels. It's not always malicious. Sometimes it's just habit. But the result is the same. Women's intellectual labor is underrecognized, even in spaces built to celebrate the Caribbean. The burden of representation. Caribbean women abroad often find themselves carrying an entire region on their backs. In art galleries, in classrooms, on TV panels, they are expected to speak not just for themselves, but for an entire culture. They are asked to explain carnival, translate patois, defend Jamaica's homophobia, comment on Haiti's instability, unpack colorism, and still smile. It's exhausting. And worse, it creates pressure to simplify or sanitize their voices, to speak